Our next speaker is Dr. Jack Barlow. Jack is an extremely busy, traveling, marketing executive, but more importantly to us, he is a director of Christian missions in many lands, and for the past 2 years, he has been editor of our missions magazine. We are deeply indebted to our brother Jack, and grateful to his wife Jean, for contributing so much of his spare time to Christian missions in many lands and to the editorship of our magazine. We are very happy to have our brother here to address us on the translations and versions of the Bible. Our brother, Dr. Barlow.
I wonder if you will, just at the very beginning, bear with me as I read two verses of Scripture. You needn't turn to them because by the time you turn to them, I'll have them read. Just two verses in Colossians chapter 1 and verses 9 and 10. And I'm sure you will feel as I read them that they haven't any direct relationship to the topic which has been assigned me this morning. But I'm sure that when I'm through, you'll be able to see a direct correlation. The Apostle Paul, of course, is speaking in Colossians 1, and this is one of the great Pauline prayers, and I pick it up at verse 9, Colossians chapter 1, verse 9. For this cause we also, since the day we heard it, do not cease to pray for you, and to desire that you might be filled with the knowledge of his will in all wisdom and spiritual understanding, that he might walk worthy of the Lord unto all pleasing, being fruitful in every good work and increasing in the knowledge of God. And Lord willing, in our last 4 or 5 minutes together, we will stop where we have started by considering those two precious verses. Now, of course, you have in front of you an outline, as our brother Taylor, I also had the opportunity to bring an outline with me. I'm going to suggest, however, that you do not particularly turn to it or use it until we pick it up in process. We will use it only in part. It was prepared for another purpose some 2 or 3 years ago. It's entirely relevant to today, but for sake of time, we will be having some other remarks and then picking up the outline where it's applicable to our study. However, since it covers a somewhat broader but closely related field than we have time for this morning, it's hard for us, as I know it is our brother Taylor's, that by taking it home with you, it may be useful to you for further study. So we will tell you when we're cutting into the outline somewhat later on. First of all, of course, as you know, part of our concern today, all of us who convened this conference, was the question of the inspiration and the inerrancy and the infallibility of Scripture. That is not my specific subtopic, but rather the versions and translations of the Scripture that we have today. But let me pause to remind ourselves that centuries ago, of course, perhaps 1500 to 1800 years before the New Testament opened, Moses himself, in some form or another, recorded the words which God had inspired to be put down. And throughout the centuries following that, until the New Testament closed, one author after the other, under the inspiration of God, set forth that which God directed them to give. Now, of course, these that I have referred to are the original writings, documents of some form or another, referred to today as autographs. And we must remind ourselves that the autographs do not exist. Nowhere today, in any repository, in any museum, in any place at all, can we find anything which says, this is the original scroll, codex, whatever it may be, parchment, perhaps a stone of some sort. This is the original. The inscriptions on this were made directly by a prophet of the Old Testament or an apostle of the New. For it was primarily the prophets and the apostles to whom were entrusted the authorization or the writing of the two testaments. The autographs do not exist. But we do have manuscripts in the original Hebrew of the Old Testament and in the Greek of the New, for these were the major languages of the Old and the New Testament, which were copies of the original autograph. And then we have copies of the copies and copies of those copies and so on down through the centuries. We will be discussing today the basis of the accuracy of this material. But we must remind ourselves that we do not have the autograph. Let me go a step further. The doctrine of inspiration that God directed word for word, as well as thought for thought, the wording of the original document, this doctrine of inspiration applies in full to every word, to every sentence, to every construct, to every meaning of the originals of the autograph. It cannot be said to apply to every version which we have in our hands today, since they are based on documents which have flowed from the autograph but are not the autograph itself. This poses, really, the very question which I would like to address with you within the framework of the time we have in the next 40 minutes. And the question is this. This is really the theme of my own remarks. How close to the autograph are the modern versions available to us today? I read, for example, from the King James Version. This is a version, a portion of it, in the English language. How close is this version to reflecting, to accurately describing the autograph which we do not possess, which we have never seen, which no longer exists? We'll get to that a little later on, and we'll subdivide it. But first of all, I would like to remind you that this topic is extremely vital today. And I have copied, in essence, a list of the importance of this topic from one of the textbooks that we shall be recommending to you later on. Why is this topic vital? It's vital in view of these present trends. First of all, the virtual abandonment of the King James Version as the official version of some groups. Church after church today in some whole denominations have abandoned the King James or Authorized Version as their version that they will have in the pews or offered as being the one that they subscribe to the best. You and I, those of us who are older, in our own lifetimes, as we grew up, there was only really one Bible. There was only the King James Version. And any idea of a multiplicity of versions never really crossed our minds unless we were particularly deep students or attending a school of theology and so on. Today, that has changed completely. Secondly, the almost complete dominance today of what are called the earlier Greek manuscripts of the New Testament. When this King James Version was written, it was based upon what are called later Greek manuscripts. Since it was written in 1611, earlier manuscripts have now been discovered, which were not available to the early translators. The earlier manuscripts are now really in the dominance so far as their acceptance by people who put together the Greek manuscripts for new Greek translations today. The dominance of the earlier manuscripts has changed the source material for the newer versions which we have in so many cases. Then in connection with the Old Testament, some of those documents are the Dead Sea Scrolls. And today, many new versions of the Old Testament are based upon a restudy of the manuscripts we had before, plus the addition of the Dead Sea Scrolls. These have been discovered in our lifetime, most of us here today. For Catholics, there has been an interesting development. New translations of Catholic Bibles are now in the main, and this is a major departure, based upon Greek and Hebrew manuscripts. They are not based as much on the Latin Vulgate. Why do I say that, and what does that terminology mean? For 1,000 years, the Vulgate, the Latin Vulgate, was the basic manuscript for the translation by Catholics of Bibles into the English and other languages. But the Latin Vulgate is itself not one of the original Greek or Hebrew languages. So the Catholics depended upon a translation of a translation. And every time one language is translated into another, something is lost in the translation. We'll talk about that later on. So this represents a very major departure for Catholic scholars. They too now are going back, as we have for a century or so or more, centuries, going back to original Greek and Hebrew manuscripts. And by the way, when I say original, I never mean the autograph. I simply mean manuscripts in the original languages that are at least centuries old. The incorporation of the principles of linguistics is also something new. We have much better knowledge today in these last 100 years of the basic underlying principles of language structure, how to understand it, how to put it together, how to understand one language, how to understand our own language, and how to better make a translation. And then another point, the adaptation, the adoption rather, this is a new trend, of a common Catholic Protestant Bible. Now, by the way, as I cite these trends, I'm not particularly indicating whether I think they're essentially good trends or bad. But these are tremendous trends in the last 50 years, even less. And these are compounding the problem of how to know which version to use. And as a result, and this is perhaps the sixth or seventh point, there is a proliferation of versions. Somebody has estimated there are at least 100 versions available to you and to me today in our English language. Which one do I pick up? Which one can I rely upon? Or which one, rather? Which one should I be skeptical of, doubtful of, or concerned about? You know, this proliferation of versions has really been brought about, as I've mentioned, because of the discovery of the older manuscripts giving fresh fuel to the fire of textual criticism and of the construction of a Greek text of the New Testament or a Hebrew of the Old. There's a better understanding of the original languages today, a greater need for keeping up with the changing English language. And may I emphasize that point? Earlier versions of the Bible in English, going back not just to the King James of 1611, but to the earlier Bibles upon which it was based, in the century or two before that. Each of the versions was written, hopefully, in the language useful for the common people of that day. There were some exceptions. But in the day of King James, in the days of the 17th century, of 1611 and around that period of time, this Bible was read and understood in the language which many people spoke, the literate people at least, of Britain and of English-speaking countries. But language changes, and everything changes faster today than it did even 20 or 30 years ago. And the dictionaries of today are out of date within 10 years. And when I have to work with the magazine, and as I speak with the tremendous help of those who are really doing most of the work in the CMML office, we have to consult a dictionary that's no older than 2, 3, 4, or 5 years. 10 or 15 years ago is a little out of date. Your language and my language, particularly if you're of the younger generation, has significantly changed since the 1930s. And it is therefore one of the objectives of translators today from the original languages into English to give a version which meets the fullest understanding of the world in which we live in the 1970s. For all of these reasons, and I've digressed a bit, there has been a tremendous proliferation of versions available to us. Now, you know, I'd like to come back again to the main thesis and restate the question which will occupy our time. How close to the autograph are the modern versions? And this really is what we will consider. But may I subdivide it into two parts and take a portion of my time on the first part and a portion on the second before concluding? Because I could ask the same question in two pieces, if you will. First of all, of course, how reliable are the original manuscripts? I have just mentioned that in recent years, even earlier manuscripts have been discovered. Do you know that we possess today over 5,000 manuscripts of the New Testament alone, of either all of it or great portions of it, together with hundreds of lesser fragments, together with, I suppose, into the thousands of other types of books, even secular authors back centuries ago, who quoted portions of scripture from the manuscripts that they must have possessed. We possess today, again as I say, thousands of manuscripts in the Greek language, in the New Testament alone. How reliable are they in reflecting the original, now non-available, autograph, which we will never be able to look at? Having looked at the reliability of the manuscript, I would like to spend the latter portion of time to say, how reliable are the translations into English from those manuscripts? What's the difference between those two questions? If I am going to go to a different language and translate into English, and then offer you a book such as whatever this may be, happens to be a hymn book, but let's say it's a secular text, translated from the original, it is vitally important that I have an accurate original document. Or, whatever I translate will carry with it every error, every omission, every sin of commission of the document that I started with. I can do no better than my original document. If this is an error, then my English version, my English translation, will also be an error. But then, let us assume that I can satisfy myself that I have an accurate original. If I am a sloppy, a poor, an ineffective, an untrained, an inefficient translator from Greek into English, or whatever language it is, then the translation I give you can be no better than my capability. Or I might even be an accurate translator, but my objective, my intent, may be something that does not suit what I translate for your purposes. In either case, I must start, first of all, with an accurate original, and then I must be an accurate professional translator from the original into the present modern-day language. We therefore have two tasks, that in the lines of the absolute trustworthiness that we can place in the Bible, we have to say to ourselves, yes, but that Bible that we possess today is based upon certain Greek and Hebrew manuscripts. Let us ask ourselves how much trust we can place in them, and it is based upon the efforts of translators to put it into English. Let us ask ourselves how much we can trust the English version from those original translations. These, then, are our tasks. First of all, I'd like to make one little digression and point out that, of course, the scope of this field is immense. This could be a one-month, two-month course, if you will, crowded into a few minutes. We must, therefore, confine our remarks, first of all, to the New Testament rather than the New and the Old, simply for sake of time. Obviously, we are confining our remarks to English versions rather than other languages. Might I say that we are particularly privileged and blessed by God, those of us who have English as a first or a second tongue, because more work has been done, more scholarship has been exhibited in translating into the English language than into any other language, with probably no exception. I cannot think of another modern language in which so much work has been done to provide for us a Bible that we can trust. In many, many languages, particularly on the mission field, there may have been only one or two people to take a native language and to translate it into that language from the Greek and Hebrew manuscript, or from even English versions of the Bible. We are particularly privileged. But what we have to say today would be as valid if it were addressed to a French audience and talking about French versions and so on. We're restricting ourselves, I say, to the New Testament for sake of time. We're restricting ourselves to translations into English. And then we will restrict ourselves primarily to translations of what, for sake of simplicity this morning, I will call Protestant Bibles. And of course, by that I mean anything which is primarily non-Catholic. A great deal of scholarship is being exhibited, particularly in these last decades, by Catholic scholars in translation as well. We have no time to discuss this morning their work in the Jerusalem Bible, the Anchor Bible, the New American Bible, and many other translations and versions in the English language. However, we trust that what we explore together in our concept will enable you also to look with some interest and determine at many of the Bibles offered by Catholic scholars as well. Now, how reliable are the Greek manuscripts upon which we base our English New Testament in the Bibles with which we're most familiar? Might I set the problem first by an analogy, if I can? Would you assume for a moment that I am going to give you an original document? Pretend that somehow or other this is the source book, the source of a completely new book that has never existed before. And I hand to each one of you, or I dictate to each one of you to make it a little more difficult, something which would run into 20 or 30 pages. If I dictated it here, it would take a considerable period of time. And as each of you sat in your seat, you would have to very carefully listen, ask me to repeat. Perhaps if you missed a word, assume you had picked it up correctly, and you would make what you felt was exactly the copy as you could. If I gave it to you already in my handwriting, then you would have to painstakingly sit down and copy my handwriting into yours if that was the task you assigned. Immediately after you finished it, without any comparison with your friends, I asked you to travel out from here and go to at least some distance of 100 miles apart from each other. Now there are perhaps 500 or 600 people here today. You would be scattered, I suppose, all over North America and go as far as you wish. I would then give you the task of sitting down with perhaps 10 people or 100 people and dictating your version of what I said to them and asking them to go out from you. If you did that, in a short period of time, there will be scores of thousands of versions of what I alone actually dictated to you in this room this morning. Let the centuries go by. Let us assume that 1,000 years go by, and scholarship of that day and age, based upon a language which may be markedly different from our own, or perhaps still some similarity with a culture different from our own, is now busy all over the world digging up or locating or finding thousands of manuscripts which bear marked similarities to each other, but which in place after place have differences. Because originally you didn't hear every word quite as your neighbor did. As you copied it, you made minor mistakes. You may have left a phrase out. You may have added something. And those who copied from you compounded your errors and added some of their own, perhaps even minor. But the scholars, having put together thousands of documents, set themselves this question. Let us compare them diligently. Let us put them side by side, and let us see if by careful overlap, by careful study, we can reconstruct what was said in that room on that occasion 1,000 years before. This is the situation in which we find ourselves in taking the manuscripts available to us and coming up with our Bible of today. How reliable are those manuscripts in the original languages? I trust that you will find, as we perhaps in the next 10 or 12 minutes deal with this topic, you will find that we can give a highly affirmative and positive answer to the reliability of the manuscripts we have available to us today. Now, in order to look at it, fortunately, this was a portion of the outline. Might I suggest to you that you take your outline, label the Bible, the miracle of its existence, and turn immediately over, for the sake of time, to page 4. I'll just give you a second or so to go to page 4. It looks and sounds as if you're practically there. On page 4, we're dealing with the New Testament document. And by the way, I do trust at home you'll take the time to read the preceding pages, which deal in parallel fashion with the Old Testament documents, and earlier than that deal with the whole question of revelation, of inspiration, transmission, and so on.
And what we have to say this morning is part of the transmission of the inspired word to us through the centuries here today. The New Testament documents, point four, halfway down the page, under A. The autographs do not exist. If they do exist, certainly they have never been found. I venture to say that they never will be found. I have a feeling that if they were found, we would begin, some of us, I don't mean here, but the general Christian population would begin to venerate or worship them, and I have a feeling that God does not intend them to be found, but has given us reliable manuscripts upon which to base our understanding. The major earliest manuscripts in the Greek, I've listed three, there are one or two others, but these are of major significance in any discussion of the sources of what we have. Notice that the first one, the Codex B, or Vatican manuscript, was written about AD 325, within the first 200 to 300 years after the Lord's sojourn on earth and his ascension, very, very early, spanning the first few generations of believers spanned this gap, we have a manuscript. The Sinaitic manuscript, Codex Aleph, from the Hebrew letter Aleph, or A, it's the same period of time discovered at Mount Sinai. I could take all morning to discuss that one. The Alexandrian manuscript, Codex A, found in about, written in about AD 450. But would you notice, please, that each of these manuscripts was not discovered until fairly recently? The Vatican manuscript only really copied in 1866. The Sinaitic manuscript only discovered in 1859. The Alexandrian manuscript only available in 1627. Now, every one of those dates is following the date upon which the King James Version was issued in 1611. Those early manuscripts were not available to the people who went to the manuscripts they did have to translate into the King James Version. Then, of course, there were other important later manuscripts, more than 2,500 of them cataloged, dating from the 9th to the 15th century. Notice that the first manuscript occurred in the 4th and 5th century, and then centuries later, all the way up to about the 15th century, we have the later group. Writings of the early church fathers helped a bit. There were also early versions at the bottom of that page, but notice, already, these were not in the original languages. There was a Syriac translation. Top of the next page, another Syriac translation. And then on item 3, near the top of page 5, the old Latin version, a translation from the Greek to Latin. And from that old Latin version, Jerome put together several manuscripts and came up at about AD 400, the date will vary here, with what is called the Latin Vulgate, meaning in the common or ordinary or vulgar tongue of the people. There's an old English word which has already shifted its meaning, hasn't it? The Vulgate or Vulgate. But the Latin Vulgate became the basis for the Catholic translation up to virtually the present day. But again, it was not based on the original language. Now, I do want to emphasize, and that's why it's point F below, this position between the early and the later manuscript. Further discussion, point F. The three and other major earliest manuscripts were available after 1611. Therefore, the authorized version, and that should be KJV, and even the RSV, don't change it, based upon the King James Version, they're both correct, published in 1611, could not reflect the value of these documents. Now, again, I want to discuss with you later whether those documents had absolutely positive or somewhat negative value. That's not the issue here. All I'm saying is that back in the 17th century, in the 1600s, as under the request of King James, and even earlier, the scribes and the scholars sat down and took their Greek manuscripts to form what we have today as the King James Version. They had manuscripts dating back as far as perhaps the 12th century. And those were obviously based on an even earlier manuscript. They did not have those manuscripts written in the 3rd and 4th century, which have been discovered since. This difference the two streams of documents, the earlier ones only available later, and the later ones available earlier, these two streams of documents have provoked a major argument which rages today in the field of translation. Since we'll be picking pieces of it up later, let me clarify it now. There are many scholars today who say that these earlier documents are of major value because in the nature of the transmission of documents and version after version over centuries, a very good principle is that the closer to the original, the freer from error. It is obvious that if you made errors in taking my dictation and you left here, somebody else is going to add more errors in taking your dictation, and so on and so on. So the closer to the original, obviously, the freer the document should be from error. But those who feel that the later documents available to the translators of the King James Version are the superior documents also have a different point of view. And they feel very, very strongly that God inspired the autograph, and God therefore must have protected to a high degree the versions that have come down to us through those later manuscripts. They do not claim inspiration for the later manuscript, but they do say that God must have protected it to a very close degree, close to the autograph. And God, perhaps in his wisdom, carefully hid the earlier manuscripts because they might have had corruption in them in terms of the corruption of the text, not of their doctrine, of course. So they say that the earlier manuscripts perhaps were corrupt and were carefully hidden until the later manuscripts had established the great flow of the King James Version and the versions arising from it that has spread throughout the civilized world and throughout the English-speaking world to 100% degree. Now, I don't know the answer to those two arguments. I'll give you some opinions a little later on. But in a faithful, sober, and careful way, I want you to have the two arguments side by side. Because as you pick up versions today, always turn to the preface or introduction, and the translators will give you their reasons for writing their translation and their source material. And you will often find words such as this in the translation based upon the later manuscripts, such as the King James. It will say, this translation is based upon the great bulk of manuscripts, because there are many, many more than the three or four early ones. Or they will say, this was based upon the Greek text of Erasmus or Stephanus. Or they will say, this is based on the received text or Textus Receptus. All these are, in a sense, synonyms for the later manuscript. However, versions based in a great part on the early manuscript, only available to us more recently, will say, these are based on the earlier manuscript. This translation is based on the older manuscript. Or this translation is based upon the critical text rather than the received text. These are some of the trade names to go by, if you will. They may also say, this is based on the Greek translations of Westcott and Hort. For Westcott and Hort were two of the earliest scholars, a century ago, a little bit more, who really took the earlier manuscripts just discovered, and in a greater degree than others, popularized them for those in the field of translation. So let me say again, the King James Version, or the received text, or Stephanus, or Erasmus, or the majority manuscripts, or the later manuscripts. However, the newer translations will often say they're based upon the critical text, they're based upon the Westcott and Hort translations, they're based upon the earlier manuscripts. Now, at the present day, there is a dominance of the earlier manuscripts, that is the Westcott and Hort approach. And most of the new versions you'll pick up will say that they are based upon the Westcott and Hort approach. However, since we have all sets of manuscripts available to us, you will often find in the footnotes and in various areas, that acknowledgement is made of all manuscripts. For example, you may find a translation, a version, which will read very, very close to the King James Version. And there might be some little superscript, like an A or an asterisk, and down at the bottom, it will say, earlier manuscripts omit word so-and-so. What earlier manuscript? They're referring to that Codex A, Codex B, Codex C, Codex Aleph, those early manuscripts which we now have. And they're trying to give us a text based upon all. Now, I've taken my time on that, but I think it's important. And I just want to go on and point out to you, as we look at it, that from this, one way or another, from either one set or another, we have the English Bibles we have today. And the history of the English Bible is listed below. I'm not going to read it word for word, since you have the notes. I simply want to point out, if you go down on page 5 to point 3, the Authorized Version, the King James Version, it was based on the available Hebrew and Greek sources, often called the received text. It was also based on the Tyndale Bible, and if you look up a couple of paragraphs, you'll see the Tyndale Bible. And the Tyndale Bible even borrowed a little bit from the Latin Vulgate, but just in small portions. So the King James or Authorized Version is based upon those later manuscripts. However, there was an English Revised Version of 1881.4, and notice the last line under that, based primarily upon Westcott and Horace. So there is where the major shift occurred. Then the American part of that team were not entirely happy with their British counterparts, so in 1901, they published the American Standard Edition of that revised version. And the American Standard Edition, or version, is very popular among scholars today. Later on, it isn't in here, a new American Standard was published under the Lockwood Foundation on the West Coast. Now, again, from the beginning of the 20th century until now, the dominance has been in the critical or Westcott and Horst text. But since there is this argument raging between the two schools, and you will see that argument reflected in any articles or in the introduction to your Bible, does this leave concern in our hearts? How much can I trust my King James Version? How much can I trust any of the other versions? You know, it's a wonderful thing that when we put them all together, we can see where there have been minor copyist errors. We can see where something may have been omitted in a third or fourth copy, or it may have been added here. And as we compare the manuscripts over the centuries, we feel it today with a tremendous degree of assurance that we're about 99.5% identical with the autograph. Let me read to you some of the wording from some of the scholars over the last century. It says, see note, there's no note attached, I'm quoting it. Westcott and Horst estimated that only about 1/8 of all the variants, that is the changes, maybe a word here, a word there, from all the manuscripts, of the thousands of manuscripts, had any weight, as most of them are merely mechanical matters such as spelling and style. On the whole, then, only about 1/60th rise above triviality, or can be in any sense called substantial variation. Mathematically, this would compute to a text that is 98.33% correct. Schaff estimated that of 150 variations, if you take 5,000 manuscripts and several hundred spell a word one way in the Greek, several hundred have it another way, you've got scores of variations right there in an inconsequential difference. Schaff estimated that only 400 of the 150,000 variant letters and so on affected the sense. Of these, only 50 were of real significance. And of this total, not one affected an article of faith or a precept of duty which is not abundantly sustained by other and undoubted passages or by the whole tenor of Scripture teaching. A.T. Robertson, the great Greek scholar of a generation or so ago, suggested that the real concern of textual criticism, which means looking at all those Greek texts, is a thousandth part of the entire text. This would make the reconstructed text of the New Testament 99.9% free from substantial or consequential error. A tremendous tribute. I could read other points as well, to indicate our absolute trust because of the tremendous variance in manuscripts available to us that we have reconstructed the original autograph. We contend on the Bible we have today. Now, how valid are the versions? Ah, this is a different story. Because my point being, and I'll take less of time than that, but how valid are the versions? I can answer that question by suggesting to you seven major principles for evaluating a version. I have them in a different form in the outline. Ignore the outline, if you will, since I trust that the form I have here might be a little better for our purposes this morning. It is of utmost importance that if I pick up a modern version, I get my feet on the ground and I make sure it's reliable. Here are seven major questions to ask, that I should ask. Number one, what are the underlying manuscripts from which this comes? Are they only the early manuscripts, only the late manuscripts, or both? Again, I'm not going to go into detail, but now with a discerning eye and an understanding mind, I can ask that question. Secondly, what type of translation is it? Is it a strict word-for-word, literal translation from Greek to English, or is it a very free-flowing, or as they call it, idiomatic, paraphrase type of translation? Because, you see, I can't have both. Ideally, I would like to take every word of the Greek, but I believe in the word-for-word inspiration of the original language of the New Testament. I believe in the verbal inspiration. When God gave a certain word, he intended that word and no other. If I could take every word of the Greek and put it into the right word in the English, that would be a literal translation. But there's no way to do that between two languages. When you so do, you lose something of the sense of the sentence or of the paragraph. So ideally, I should have a perfect word-for-word, a perfect sense-for-sense. I cannot have it both ways, but I must have the best marriage of the two. And when I pick up a translation, if it is strictly word-for-word, it will be highly accurate technically to the words, but it will lose something of the sense and will be awkward and in rather stilted English for my use today. If it's free-flowing, it can be far less accurate and have serious errors in it, and yet give an overriding sense of the sentences or paragraphs. I have no time to give you illustrations this morning, perhaps later on. A second question is, the third question is, what is the quality of the English? For you know, there can be somebody who really knows the Greek and answers the first two questions correctly in his work and is very poor at the structure of the English. The English should be understandable. It should be unambiguous, and let me say this, dignified and reverent. And I do not have too much sympathy with translations today which are so free-flowing that they're in colloquial slang English in order to apparently reach a small segment of the population. I do not want to bring God down to man in my translation. I want to raise man to God, and I can do it with correct English, which is understandable to all. I do not need to go into slang or colloquialism. Fourth, who were the translators? Were they an individual or a group? Obviously, there's strength in a group. What theological background is there? What training is there? Fifth, what associations or denominations approve this translation? And sometimes I can be put on the alert if it's a liberal association or denomination and they say, we endorse this unqualifiedly. Sixth, what are the declared aims and objectives of the translators? Because each translator translates or group for a particular set of aims and objectives. Some have aimed at reaching people with limited English. Some have aimed at a scholar's translation. I should know that. And closely allied to it is my seventh question, and I really close on this question, except to go back to my text. What is my intended use? Or might I suggest to you several different uses that you may have as you pick up and use the Bible. If it's for private reading, I can get away with a free-flowing and perhaps an accurate translation, because at least I have the discernment to compare it with a better translation and to ask myself why it's apart. But sometimes the free-flowing can give me an appreciation of a sense of a paragraph, perhaps, so I wouldn't get otherwise. If it is for careful study, then I want the best critical translation I can get. And I recommend the American Standard of 1901 and the New American Standard from that. Again, I am no authority. I'm sure you'll come to me with questions on each of these. But at least that is a good critical text that I can use for private study. For readers with limited English background, and here perhaps something which might not be as highly accurate for other purposes, I can get away with. Today's English version, a good news for modern man and with all its problems, and I'll get to that, perhaps somebody has a limited English background and they'll at least understand the main sentences and paragraphs in such a version. For careful literal translation of the Greek, here's another one. I can pick up an interlinear where it has the Greek and a word for word underneath. Or weep or woof, I don't know how to pronounce them. His translation of the Bible, it's more than a translation, really. Now, how about for memorization? And I'm indebted to our brother Fred Hamilton for this. He's reminded us and warned us that if you're giving young people, or still Sunday school children, memory work, stick with the King James Version. This is the best known. It's in Reverend English. It's in Majestic English. And they'll be memorizing a common version with other young people and with their elders. How about for preaching for the pulpit? For public preaching, the King James Version only, so far as I'm concerned. I do not want to get up, and even with a Bible that I feel is tremendously accurate, have to apologize over and over and say, the Bible you have isn't quite right, I have the correct one. Because uninformed may feel that I'm casting discredit on the original inspired Word of God. Let me come back. I've had a bit more, but my time is up, and I want to come back to the verses that I read. Let me read them to you. Colossians 1, verse 9. For this cause also, wouldn't notice, please, is at least four times, if not five, that some word synonymous with knowledge is in these two verses. For this cause we also, since the day we heard it, do not cease to pray for you and to desire that you might be filled with the knowledge of his will in all wisdom and spiritual understanding. There's three. That you might walk worthy of the Lord unto all pleasing, being fruitful in every good work and increasing in the knowledge of God. How can I get a knowledge of God? I must go to God's written word. This is the basis. But if I go to his written word, two things are vitally important. I must have an accurate manuscript from which to translate, or I'm in trouble to start with. And I must have an accurate English translation, or else I am in further trouble. Friends, brethren, and sisters this morning, might I urge you, if someone is starting, a young person perhaps, on one of the, and I say it frankly, more corrupt, free-flowing, almost colloquial paraphrases, which have several errors in them, well and good if this is their first introduction, and this is what they feel is the Bible, and they've been led to Christ through it. Don't disparage it, or you may destroy that beginning faith. But wean them as soon as possible to a knowledge of the deeper things of God based upon a study of a reliable translation.